The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from the Clark County Public Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, Wright Memorial Library, and Dayton Metro Library.
Hello, welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis. And today we are going to go back to the year 2000, when I had an opportunity to interview a writer who came in to our studios all the way from Edinburgh, Scotland. She had never been to Ohio before. Her name was Dorothy Dunnett. She was a very well-known writer and wrote a lot of books. And she came out to see us to talk about what turned out to be her final book. Dorothy passed away the year after we recorded this interview. Let's listen now to Dorothy Dunnett talking about her novel, Gemini. It's the best of the Book Nook. Good afternoon, Miami Valley. Welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. I'm Vic McCunis, and it's my absolute pleasure to be joined in studio by Dorothy Dunnett. Hello, Dorothy.
Hello, Vic.
It's a long way from Edinburgh.
Yes, it is, and the weather is a lot better than it is in Edinburgh, I can tell you that. It's lovely here.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, it was terrible. I landed in Philadelphia about 10 days ago. It was teeming rain, and I went on to Washington. It was teeming rain, and I went on to Raleigh, and it was cloudy. And it was all right in New York, but it's not as nice as this. And the trees are just beginning to go, huh? The fall's coming.
Just starting.
Yeah.
Have you ever been to Ohio before?
No, I haven't. I have been to, is Chicago a word I may mention on this program?
Certainly.
I can, that's good. Because one of my sons decided to top up his British degree with an MBA at Chicago at Kellogg's and went across with his wife and produced my first grandson, now age six, who therefore belongs to Chicago and is a United States citizen. Isn't that something?
I'll say.
So we're working on Ohio.
Dorothy, I think we might have at least one or two listeners out there who are not familiar with your work. Could you give us a little biography? How long have you been doing this, and what have you been writing?
Like one or two readers, that's a very tactful way of putting it. To the 5 million people who've never heard me before, I've been writing for 40 years. It's dreadful, it really is dreadful. I'm a portrait painter by profession. And my husband was a newspaper editor. And noticing that I loved reading historical novels and then had kind of run out of the kind I liked to read, he said, why don't you write your own? And you know, you never say no to a newspaper editor. Never. So I wrote, and then he added, and why not make it a series at the same time? And then walked out. No, that was it. And I then went on to write 23 books, which wasn't what he had in mind, I think, actually. I do still paint in between times, but they're there. So there are two historical series, of which this book, just finished, Gemini, is the eighth and last of the second series. And they're set, first series was set in high Renaissance in Europe in the 16th century. And this one, The House of Niccolo, is set 100 years earlier, at the very beginning of the Renaissance. And the trick was, or is, that they each have the most charismatic central character I could conceivably devise. The first series was around a chap called Francis Crawford of Lymond. And that book came out in New York. My first publishers were in New York by fluke. In 1961, and the world is full of children called Francis, after Francis Crawford, and Philippa, after the girl he married, and dogs called Lewis, after the dog that runs through the sixth series. I decided to make, it came out about the time that James Bond was coming out, and we knew Ian Fleming, in fact, my husband knew him quite well. And I thought, right, he is writing the spy to end all spies. And I am going to devise the hero to end all heroes. And little did I know what I was doing, because they're all still in print. That is the first series about Lymond. And the original readers are still rereading, and their children are still rereading, and now their grandchildren are rereading. So, second series... central figure, Nicholas, very different, a merchant adventurer, a chap who's good with numbers, ever good with banking, which was just beginning at that time, mm-hmm. but floating all around the world because I like travelling too. And all the titles are astrological. First titles were chess for Lyman. And these are astrological. Gemini, meaning twins, is the last one, and that's uh-huh. it.
And here we've actually come to the end of this series. What's next?
That is in the hands of the geriatric care industry. One of my sons asked me that the other day, and I said, well, you know, you never know when you're going to go gaga in this world. And there was a kind of long silence, and then he said, what makes you think you haven't gone gaga? Oh, the answer is I don't know. I started this year. This book came out in Britain earlier this year. So I've been in Australia. I did an Australian tour from Adelaide to Melbourne to Sydney in February and March, and then a British tour. And then this one, which is going on for about 2.5 weeks. And in both sides of the Atlantic, there have been huge gatherings, readers, 300 for a long weekend in Edinburgh, people from Australia and New Zealand and Germany and the States, Canada, Turkey, Malta, you name it. And then in Philadelphia last weekend, 220 or 30 people from South Africa and Germany and 20 from Canada, 20 from Texas. And we had a wonderful time. In addition, sorry, am I going on too long?
No, this is wonderful.
You are not dead bored. He's not dropping dead from boredom yet. Both in Edinburgh and here, my readers put on a spoof opera based on the story of Nicholas, the central character of these 8 books, and based on the music of Gilbert and Sullivan, right, called the Nicado. It's rather sweet, and I won't tell you all about it because it went on forever. It was wonderful. They've given me a printed libretto of it with all the cast. The cast were from all over the world, 40 singers from all over the world who had been drilled through the internet and by CDs and things and had never met one another till the night before. So there we are, art and history and everything else all mixed up.
In case you've just tuned in, my guest is Dorothy Dunnett, and she's just written Gemini, and it's the final book in a long-running series.
There are a number of people who really are very interested in the books, who came particularly to the Philadelphia conference, and some of them then went on to the other places where I was speaking to continue the conversation, as it were. The only trouble is most of them are on the internet, and in touch with one another by email. There is something, if you take a search engine, a bigger one like Google, and type in Dorothy Dunnett, you know, in quotes, you get just under 3,000 sites. And about 7 of these are readers' discussion groups. I mean, nothing to do with me. They say, I'm not allowed on. Mm-hmm. You know, they can kind of say, isn't she ghastly? And we hate her. And did you notice that mistake? And I would never know. And I think that's right, you know. But what they have done, actually, they presented me with 3 volumes from 2 different websites of the best of what they have published amongst themselves on my work, and also messages from each of them of how they first came across one of my books, which is really rather nice. But the downside is that they tend to go to wherever I am, and then they email on to wherever I'm going to be next with the follow-up questions that they didn't ask the night before.
Oh.
Or, you know, so that I feel they are going to chant what I'm going to say before I say it, because it's very difficult to vary it that much. But it's lovely. I have hundreds of friends.
Wow. Well, Dorothy, it was very helpful to me, since I have to confess that I've started this series by reading the last book,
yes. Good. You don't need to read the others if you don't like it, then. That's a very wise thing to do.
Your list of characters at the beginning I found to be rather daunting, and fortunately you have this wonderful introduction to the book, which was written in the hopes of bringing us up to speed, I think,
with the
other books in the series by Judith Wilt. Now, I'm guessing Judith Wilt must have a story of her own.
Yes, she's a professor at Boston College who came across my books in the very early days and got in touch with me and has spoken on them. These conferences I was talking about that are taking place this year have been underway ever since 1990, when all my readers suddenly discovered through the internet and through Correspondence magazine that there were other readers out there who also liked my books. So they then thought it would be lovely if they could all get together and know one another in person instead of over the internet through the magazines. So a big conference was held in Edinburgh, and then 2 years later in Boston, and then 2 years later in Edinburgh. And a number of speakers came, and Judith is, I think, the only person who's actually come to each of them and given an academic talk on what lies behind the historical research, which is fairly intensive. For the Lyman series, I consulted or read something like 600 books. And for the Nicholas series, rather more, about 700 books. So there's a lot of work in it. So there are a lot of different angles from which one can discuss it, the history or the fiction or the plot or the mysteries or whatever. And she's been wonderful at that. As they developed, as you know, they're rather large books. In fact, before I came here, I signed in Edinburgh for mailing 1.1 metric tons of Gemini in a rather old bookstore, a very famous old bookstore with rather rickety floors. And it was the kind of stuff over the weekends. And Bill Marshall, who runs the website belonging to the store, was unpacking crate after crate, and I was signing book after book. And if somebody came in, he would say, "Don't stand there, don't stand there. That's a little further to the left, you'll be safe." And I was telling this to my son. I'm sorry I keep bringing in my sons, but they're my severest critics. And one of them said, "Well, Mum, the size of books you write, that for 1.1 metric tons was probably three books." Which is fair enough. But what you're meant to do, it's up to you, what you're meant to do is kind of gallop through for the story, because it's not like Hornblower or Patrick O'Brien in the sense that it's add-on books. This is another adventure of this guy. This is another adventure of this guy. Now he's gone to Russia. Now he's gone to Turkey. Now he's gone to Africa. It is 10 years or 20 years in the life of this very charismatic character whom you meet when he's very young. In the case of Nicholas, he's only 18. And there is an ongoing series of mysteries that run right through the whole series. I have to plan the eight books before I begin to write the eight books, because the clues have got to be there. Therefore, it's puzzle upon puzzle upon puzzle. But people race through it for the romance. Does he get the girl? Whatever, whatever. Or does he get killed? Do his friends get killed? Do his enemies kill him or injure him? And then what they do is they go back for all the clues and they reread. The two series are linked. So if they get to the end of this series, the Nicholas series, you can start at the beginning of the Lyman and then work your way through and then begin to see what some of the subplots are. And then second time round again, and the third time round still more. And this is why they're still arguing over the internet about the meaning of the books, because it depends on how you interpret all these clues. And I have to be very careful when I'm speaking on this kind of tour. They try and trick me. It's like a war game. Because certainly by this book has the main answers to everything in the previous books. And if you don't want to read the previous ones, you read Judith Wilt's very, very good summary at the beginning and then follow it from there. But if you're interested, then you go back and think, oh, that's why he did that and that's why she did that, and pick up all. The record for rereading is held by a lady who read the whole thing 19 times. And is probably blind, but, you know, blind but happy, I hope.
But that includes the last book?
That includes. I'm not sure she lived that long.
You're listening to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO, and today I'm looking back at an interview I recorded back in the year 2000. It was the fall of 2000, and Dorothy Dunnett had come to Ohio on book tour. She was from Edinburgh, Scotland, and she had never been to Ohio before. And I was thoroughly charmed by her. She came out to talk about her final novel, Gemini, which came out that year. And she was known for her historical novels. But before she became a writer, she was known as a portrait artist. And she apparently had quite a reputation as a portrait artist and made portraits of some very well-known people. And she even wrote a series of books about a portrait artist. We'll continue with my conversation with Dorothy right after this. You're listening to 91.3 WYSO, giving voice to our community, our nation, and our world since 1958. I'm Vic McCunis, and I'm bringing you the best of the Book Nook this morning and reprising an interview I recorded 18 years ago with Dorothy Dunnett. She came out to see me in the fall of 2000, and she was publicizing her last book. It was a novel called Gemini, and she died the following year. Dorothy Dunnett was born in Scotland in August of 1923, and she died in November of 2001. And she was known as a portrait artist before she became a novelist. She was a professional portrait painter and exhibited at the Royal Scottish Academy on many occasions. She had portraits commissioned by a number of prominent Scottish public figures. We'll continue now with the best of the Book Nook on WYSO. Dorothy, if I'm hearing you, when you started the Lyman series, you foresaw both series clear to the end already? You had it all planned out?
I had the Lyman series planned, not the other one. I thought this was the only set of books I was ever going to write. And I planned that on its own. Then I suddenly thought, why am I only writing historical novels? Maybe this is the only kind. Just because I was pointed in that direction. I mean, so I went on and wrote, I think, seven thrillers, because it was rather nice to make jokes, which you couldn't fit into the 15th century. I kept thinking of great things for Nicholas to say, and then, you know, it had to do with electricity or something, forget it. So I wrote all these, and I wrote a one-off book about King Macbeth called King Hereafter. And then one of my American editors phoned me up and said, Dorothy, what about another series? And I thought, having seen the work it involved, to do a one-off in another period, you have to read up a whole different period. Whereas for a series, at least you do all your background reading at the beginning, and then individual reading, of course, for the books. So I decided to do this series on Nicholas. But the thing was, I wanted it to link. I wanted the Nicholas, people who were in the Nicholas book, the fictitious people, as against the thousands of historical characters, to be the antecedents, the forebears of Lyman, so that by Gemini, you see how the bloodline is coming down and how it's going to produce Lyman in the long run. So that it was a little tricky, because I hadn't prepared the ground, of course, in the Lyman books, as I didn't know I was going to write another series, but it sort of works. And for 16 years, all the Lyman readers have been avidly pursuing all these Niccolo books, trying to work out who was going to marry whom and who was going to have which child and which child was going to marry what. And it's been great fun. It's still going on.
So you really had a transposition then.
That's right. Particularly as the later series was set earlier on. It got very confusing. For years now, I've been dating my letters 1478. You know, it's a bit... correspondents are used to it.
In case you've just tuned in, you're listening to the Book Nook on WYSO, and Dorothy Dunnett has joined us all the way from Scotland, and she's in Ohio for the very first time. Let's talk about Nicholas and how he has been transformed over that 20-year period. When he started off, he was quite a bit different, wasn't he?
Yes, because Lyman had been the war leader of mercenaries, and therefore you could put him into the highest circumstances, and he would be a flamboyant and a swordsman and so on. Nick, I thought, let's try somebody who is quite different and watch him develop and see how he develops. So Nicholas starts as a dyeyard apprentice at the age of 18 in Bruges, which was one of the money centres and trading centres of the world in the 15th century. It was the time I was writing was the time when the young men in the present day could go and make a fortune on the stock exchange, you know, in Tokyo or in Wall Street or in London. There were chaps coming from nowhere and becoming multimillionaires, you know. And I thought this was happening in the 15th century because banking was appearing for the very first time. The Medici were starting their banks. And people like this could, just because they had a flair for numbers, could become very important. Of course, at that time, banking was connected with trading. Trading was connected with exploration. So I could take him all over the known world. So he gains control of the company one way or another by marrying his boss, in fact, when he's still very young. And she sends him to Trebizond, which I was quite keen to visit. And it's quite extraordinary. It's rather a decayed area now. It's quite difficult to get to, or it was when I went there. You have to fly to Ankara, to Istanbul, and then Ankara, and then a local plane there. Mm. And they're very unused to lone women trailing around Trebizond, I can tell you. But anyway, he added to his experience and fortune there. He learns to fight. He learns to ride a horse, all the things that young men of limited background couldn't do. It takes him a while before he can achieve the same standing as the other merchants and senior merchants and statesmen he finds himself among. But he grows and develops. But all the time, what we don't know, we like him. He's warm-hearted and he's funny and he's generous and he's accommodating. And he accepts a correction and almost, he accepts attack almost. He's the perpetual underling. And then you discover that perhaps there's more to it than that. He is a very, very intelligent young man, and that he's not going to be content to be like this all the time. So what it is as he moves around the world, making enemies, making friends, finding lovers, you never quite know whether his better nature is going to defeat his worse nature, mm-hmm. how he's going to end up. And that's the main dilemma that isn't solved until the very last book.
Which is this book.
Gemini, yes.
Bruges is now in what is known as Belgium.
Yes, yes.
And I understand it's still a beautiful city.
It's lovely, and a lot of readers go there. In fact, there's a famous touring agency called Swan Tours, which often takes Bruges in. And the tourist guides in Bruges got a little confounded when everyone would pour off a Swan Tour ship and say, could you take us to all the places connected with Nicolas de Fleury? Who? So what happened was there was one specific guide, Maria, who kind of took everybody who was interested in Nicholas off to show them Nicholas places. But there's a very, very important citizen of Bruges, a nobleman, in fact, called Anselm Adorn, who had built his own palace and an adjoining church, still to be seen, called the Jerusalem Church. And in the church is the effigy of Adorn and his wife. And I was interested because I went to visit the church. I knew I wanted to use Bruges. I went to see the church. I saw the effigy. I found there was a leaflet in Flemish, which I am not really conversant with. But it mentioned the date I was interested in, about the late 1400s, and mentioned that he died in Scotland. And I thought, wait. Dumb minute, I can use this, let's find out more. And in fact, what I found out had not been thoroughly explored by any historian, professional historian. And I was able to follow his whole life. He was a burgomaster of Bruges. He was his family were the Doges of Genoa. He was Italian in origin. But he formed a friendship with the King of Scotland. And eventually, when after several wars he had to leave Bruges, he came and ended his life there. And if you see the effigies in the Jerusalem Kirk, and it's a beautiful place, it's full of canals, it's like a little Venice, even prettier in some ways. You see Anselm Adorn is wearing the collar of the unicorn, which is the very oldest of the Scottish honours. And it's a forerunner of the Order of the Thistle, which is the current very, very old order. And when the Queen came to open an exhibition in Edinburgh on the Order of the Thistle, they showed her a collar of the Order of the Unicorn taken from Anselm Adorn's tomb, and the story of Anselm Adorn and of the collar runs all through the Nicholas stories. So the Queen was given a copy of the collar. They have one in the castle, and I've got the other one.
Oh, my. So he's a real person.
He's a real person, yes.
I remember in the book that initially he's the name that shall not be spoken.
Yes, yes. You do not know what... He is a very important man. You don't know what's going to happen, and you don't know how his story winds into Nicholas's. At the end, he must have been an extraordinary man. He went on a great pilgrimage to the Far East. I had to go to St. Catherine's Monastery in the Sinai Desert to follow him for part of this pilgrimage. I went to Alexandria first because I had some scenes to set there, then to Cairo, and then I'd phoned up my travel agent, a sweet man called Ian, and he's used to me ringing up and saying, I want to be in Turkey on Tuesday, or can you get me to the Crimea by a week on Wednesday? And he always does it. He sent me down the Vistula, you know, from Gdansk down to Torun and got me in and out of this. However, in this instance, St. Catherine's Monastery on Mount Sinai, and he said, Dorothy, how do I get you across the Sinai Desert and into a monastery? And I said, Ian, I leave it to you. I am absolutely sure you're going to do it. And he did it. It was a little fraught. This enormous car with a driver from Aswan, stately behind the wheel, who had no English and no French and spoke no language I knew, but was accustomed to taking tourists to places I didn't want to go. So we went under the Suez Canal, which was interesting, and then the desert is a kind of wilderness. It's rocks and kind of wind-scarred hills, and it takes 6 hours to cross it. We kept stopping in places I didn't want because other tourists generally stopped there, and I would have to signal St. Catherine's Monastery, just St. Catherine's Monastery. And Ian got me into a kind of little bunch of chalets close at hand. I didn't have to sleep there. And it's wonderful. I recommend it to anybody. They've got wonderful, wonderful old manuscripts there. Dozens of them.
How exotic. Dorothy, I have to surmise that you can read some of these archaic languages.
Well, I wish you were right, but I'm sorry to say. I have everything based on Latin I can kind of get away with. And terrific in 15th century French, really terrific. It's not much goose when you go and go to On the Metro in Paris, or whatever, I have to tell you. But there's not a chance that anyone like me could read original manuscripts. I had a friend who was working for the Frescobaldi family, who live in a palace on the Arno in Florence, right? And all their family archives are in one room, locked room, and they never have been translated. And this friend went there, and what they do is they recruit experts, young experts, to come for about 6 months or as long as they can, and just go on with scroll after scroll after scroll and try and make out what they can, and then they go and sign. Because every scribe has their own way of writing, their own method of abbreviation, and she said it takes you 6 months to make out what the habit of this scribe is so you can read the bit that he's written. And by the time you've done that, you're onto another scribe and you don't know what the heck he's talking about. So you've got, you know, somebody else comes in. Which is why Yale University, I think, has just bought a whole heap of similar archives from another very old Italian family. And they're coming out at the rate of one volume every 3 years. I mean, it takes, and it's very frustrating when you're like me, when you're writing, trying to find the latest information about all these families, and you know this information is there somewhere. It's going to come out and contradict everything I've said. It's dreadful.
Now, the Frescobaldis, they were like the Antinori's, they're big Tuscan wine merchants,
yes,
weren't they?
Yes, uh-huh. And they just ventured into, actually, the boasting, we were invited to drinks by the Comte and the Contessa, whose sons go to Scotland, or went, they're probably grown up, grandparents by now, went to Scotland to school, for their schooling. And they had their farms are about 40 miles away from they have a cathedral as well as their home in the Arno. The family cathedral's just in the backyard.
Just part of the palazzo.
That's part of the palazzo, exactly. And the Count crosses the Arno on his bicycle every day because the traffic is so dreadful to get to his office. But in the heat of the summer, I said, what do you do about mosquitoes, thinking of the Scottish midges? And he said, oh, every evening we have our cars draw up, and he said, we all get into them, and our cook and the butler and everyone else, and we drive to our farm, and we have a very peaceful, quiet night away from the water. Added to that, he is experimenting in sparkling wines. Mm. So the whole conversation was topped up with a little specimen of their latest product, which was lovely. I recommend that too.
Oh my. I was in Florence this last spring. And
where are you? Lovely. Duomo, everything.
Love it. Went to the Palazzo Antinori, where they have the...
Oh, right, yes,
they have
yes.
The special wines that they don't...
They don't spread around. They let you in. They light your face and let you in. And did you go up the hill to Fiesole?
Oh, for sure.
Yes.
Went up to the Etruscan Museum up there.
Oh,
And the Roman amphitheater.
Yes.
Beautiful.
It is wonderful. And you're going back again.
I can't get enough of that place.
Good. You should. Go to Siena also.
I've heard that's beautiful there as well.
It is lovely. It's a portrait, a kind of fantasy portrait of the King of Scotland there, because the Pope, who was a Piccolomini, who became Pope Pius at the age of 35, I think. No, I'm wrong. In 1435, as a young man, before he was Pope, obviously, went as an envoy to Scotland and was shipwrecked virtually off the coast of Scotland, and said that he would walk to the nearest shrine to thank the deity for having spared him. And his feet were never the same again, I gather. But he was fairly healthy in other respects. He sired a son while he was there, which is interesting. But the child died. And he was a wonderful... His memoirs, Pope Pius XI, am I talking about? His memoirs are very racy and very charming. He was a poet. He wrote love lyrics as a young man. And he used to write the love letters for Duke Sigismund of the Tyrol, who is a very attractive gentleman with a lot of lady friends that couldn't write love letters, and the Pope-to-be did it for him. So read his memoirs, and The Merchant of Prado is another wonderful book about the whole early Tuscan area. Yes, you must go back.
You are listening to The Best of the Book Nook on WYSO as we go back to the year 2000 and my interview with Dorothy Dunnett, recorded live in studio right here at WYSO in the fall of 2000 for what turned out to be her final book. And I loved it during the interview 18 years ago that she kept talking about the internet. She was hip to the internet. She said, yeah, if you go into Google and search for my name, you'll come up with 3,000 items, 3,000. She was amazed by that. Well, if you put Dorothy Dunnett's name in Google now, you'll come up with 254,000 items. How the internet has expanded over the last 18 years. And Dorothy Dunnett was really an amazing person. I was so charmed by her. We'll continue with my interview with Dorothy right after this. The Best of the Book Nook continues on WYSO as we go back to the year 2000 and a novel called Gemini, written by Dorothy Dunnett. She came out to see us in Yellow Springs in the fall of 2000 on book tour. She had never been to Ohio before. And she died the following year in November of 2001. This turned out to be her final book in a review in the year 2000. A reviewer in the Times Literary Supplement wrote, "Although Dunnett's writing style is not the neutral prose of genre fiction, and it can be opaque and hard to read, especially in the early works, at times this works with the almost melodramatic content to produce a powerful operatic mixture. It is neither as a literary novelist nor as a historian, but as a writer of historical fiction, that Dorothy Dunnett deserves recognition. The publication of Gemini completes an ambitious literary circle." She finished that long series with this final book, Gemini. Let's listen now to Dorothy Dunnett on The Best of the Book Nook. Dorothy, I was intrigued as I read the book, the way that you can control and comprehend all of these different lines of information and these different circumnavigations and bits of history intertwine. It's just phenomenal. How do you do it? What's the process when you're writing?
The process is the start of the history, really. In this instance, as I was saying, the cutoff date was, as it happens, I can now say that Gemini is out, is the death of Anselm Adorn. So I had the cutoff date. I had to make my hero pretty young at the beginning so that he wasn't too old. As the story progressed, you have to start your girls even younger. You can get away with a kind of 30 or 40 year old hero, but you know, yeah. So the girls all start very, very young. So I knew what the span was. And so I read very, very widely in the history of the whole of, you know, as it is, the Mediterranean, North Africa, the Middle East, the Near East, the Northern countries, and spotted what I wanted where I wanted to go, the themes I wanted, the history I wanted. Ivan the Terrible's grandfather was ruling in Russia, and I wanted to get there. Sultan Mehmet was in Turkey, and I wanted him to go there. The Knights of the Order of St. John were variously in Malta and in Rhodes during these two series, and I could show the differences, how they were dealing with the battle against Islam in their view.
Are these in the Knights Templar?
No, it isn't. The Knights Templar had gone in disgrace by this time, but they'd been followed and, in fact, had been parallel with the Knights of St. John. They were Knights Hospitaller. And they came into being during the early Crusades as a hospital, as physicians, actually. They ran the hospitals on the sites of the Crusades. Ah. But they were also a great seamen, and in this series of volumes, their headquarters were at Rhodes, which is a lovely island. I, again, recommend that. They have wonderful palaces there. And they had a huge fleet. And it was that fleet which was the kind of bulwark against the spread of Islam, which everybody was fearing so much. But, of course, Venice, which always looked two ways anyway, was very vulnerable to Islam and, in fact, was almost overwhelmed at one stage. But her traders kept trading all the time because, you know what you do? It's like the present day. You've got to take the long view. These are the guys, once the war's over, these are the guys you're going to have to do business with still. So you kind of trickle on with the kind of relationship and the government just sort of winks the little eye. And it's fascinating actually unearthing all of that and seeing all the parallels between then and today. So this is what I was looking for. And in Scotland, the Stuart kings were reigning at that time. And it was very interesting about them because the Stuarts who were on the throne at this time, James III, had a lot of sisters and brothers. And they were very willful and violent and unpredictable. And then I went to see the film The Madness of King George.
Great movie.
Great movie. Mm-hmm. And this was in the film, they explained what had been scientifically proved, I think, by that time, that it wasn't outright insanity that was a problem with him, but it was an illness called porphyria, which can be carried down, and it's been proved has been carried down into the descendants of King George III, which causes this kind of behavior and also a red flush to the skin. And his father, James III's father, was known as James of the Fiery Face, which is interesting. And if James III was the great grandfather of Mary, Queen of Scots, and it's thought that she was a carrier, perhaps, or even suffered from porphyria. So if all that is true, it's possible that that was the reason for the curious behavior of the royals. It's not been proved, so I just kind of float the idea. But this is the kind of thing, the research, before I begin, I look into all of these possibilities, and then I've got my fiction story, Nicholas and his family, and the people who come to join his company, who first of all, you know, don't think much of him, then gradually become friends of his. His enemies, the people that he is afraid of, in fact. And there are only about 30 of those, 30 fictitious characters, but as you noted, there are about 600 actual, genuine ones. So there's a huge amount of reading, and sometimes it leads into historical areas that haven't been explored by professional historians because they go for, you know, the big stories and the important things, and I'm going for more of the sidelines where I'll come across an actual character with a very strong bearing on Scottish affairs, for example, and then I'll go into the real nitty-gritty of the Scottish archives and dig out more and more and more, as I did for Anselm Adorn in Scotland, and find a framework I can fit my story into. But it has to be done very quickly because in a series you're expected to issue a book about every 2 years or people forget what you're writing about. And I forget what I'm writing about. So it's all done at great speed. I am a very fast writer, fortunately.
My guest is Dorothy Dunnett. Dorothy, I love language. I love words. Clearly you do as well. And it was such a treat for me to read the book, and about every page or so I would see an old word that I did not know, and it was such a treat for me to see these words.
I used to be edited in New York by a man called Harvey Ginsberg, a wonderful editor belonging to G.P. Putnam at that time. And he and I had a wonderful night out in New York last night, I must tell you. But he told me at the beginning, and he reminded me last night, that when he came to edit a book, he said he had a dictionary out for me and Nabokov. Pretty good.
That's
pretty
good. That's
yes.
Very good.
Yes, yes. Actually, it keeps all my readers going because they're great. You know, the Renaissance is a wonderful time, so I bring in a lot of the music and a lot of the poetry and a lot about the paintings. And the internet means that people can grab around and find what my sources were and say, she mentions Memling's Last Judgment. If you look up such and such a site on the internet, such and such a gallery, you'll actually see a reproduction. Or she mentions this kind of costume, you'll find it in a painting by, and they tell one another this, which is wonderful. There is a little Renaissance band, it's a very, very esoteric business, in Edinburgh, which comes and plays Lyman and Nicholas music, as they call it, at these gatherings and makes CDs and things. But they will find, there's a poem that I use running all the way through that starts, Tant que je vive. And it's a very, very old one. It's not known to be set to music, but they have found music of the period which suits it exactly. And when I was in Edinburgh, we had a banquet in Stirling Castle in the banqueting hall for 300 people. One of the culminating, it's the highlights of the weekend, everybody being there. And at the end of the banquet, the Swedish ambassador to Germany, who I do not know, who is apparently a lifelong reader of my books, had flown over from Berlin for one night to present me with a volume which had been in preparation for 2 years from my readers all over the world. And what had happened is they had written 2 years ago, a group of readers on my behalf, I knew nothing about this, to people who were at school with me, people who had served on committees with me, friends who had had to do with the founding of Scottish Opera, friends in America, from each continent, one reader. And there were about 90 submissions in this book with tributes or paintings or pieces of needlework with original designs to do with the books. And one of them was Tant que je vive, by the person who runs this band, set to music and beautifully laid out in a musical page. Now, isn't that marvelous?
How lovely.
Yes.
It sounds like you're having a lot of fun.
Yes, I had no idea. It's the interaction between the writing and the reading and the readers, which has been accelerated by the internet. That is why, I think. What happened was when it got to about 2,000 people writing to me, I had to say, I can't write back. I can't write the books if so many, because of the kind of puzzle nature and the openness to interpretation. People wanted to know, get answers. So what happened was a group of readers in Chicago in 1984, started a letter zine, a correspondence magazine, so that people who had queries for me or wanted to discuss something wrote a letter into them, and then they published it every 2 months in the form of this correspondence magazine, Xeroxed it out for no profit, just, you know, for cost to them all. But it's now all over the world. I mean, in Edinburgh alone, they print 600 copies every 3 months. And it's exactly that. People write in, and then other people next issue will say, I know the answer to that, it's so and so and so and so. And if after a year or so there are questions that nobody has answered, then they all send them to me and I will give them a kind of omnibus. But then they discovered the internet and they found they could do this. They are passing, I think, on the private website called Done It Work. There's another one called Marzipan. They each have about 600 subscribers and they're passing messages at the rate of several hundred every day. As I said, I'm not allowed on it, and this may be just as well. I haven't got time to read them.
What's the significance of almond paste?
Oh, cognac, was this? Or almond paste?
Marzipan.
Marzipan and kisses. Oh, yes, yes. Sorry, I'm probably blaring in your ears.
That's okay.
Well, when the first letter zine started in Chicago, they simply wrote and said, would I give them permission to do it, that I needn't be involved in it at all, but they'd love to do it among their friends. And I said, of course, I'm terribly flattered. And then found it was going to be called Marzipan and Kisses. So I thought, right. I hadn't, it's rather like the time one of my books was reviewed under the heading Bodice Ripper of the Week. And I thought, it got me a lot of new readers. I mean, it was great. But I thought, this is not quite. And then I remembered in one of the Lyman books, I had been describing the rather decadent court of France at the time under François Premier as a court of marzipan and kisses and gave me this and what. It went on in a rather more erudite fashion after that. But they had pitched on this. It then, because they themselves, I think, became a little worried about it, it became reduced to M and K, which, as they said, sounds like a breakfast cereal, actually. And then when it got too big for them, they had identical magazine letters done every 3 months in Edinburgh, which looks after all the Brit side and Australia, New Zealand and so on. And it calls itself Whispering Gallery, which is quite nice too. The websites, I mean, there's a website in Clace, there's one in Dunnet Dumb, there's one in Lyman, there's one in Game of Kings, there's this one, Dunnet Works, this one, Marzipan. There are two in Germany, in German, which are open. I mean, they are, I can read them if I knew German, which I don't. It's the most infuriating. I don't know what they're saying about me.
Dorothy, I see we're running out of time. The minutes just flew away having you here. I have just enough time, I think, for one more question. Right. I'm curious. When we began today, you mentioned that you had been reading some works in this genre and that you started writing because you were advised by your husband that you should start writing your own books. I'm curious to know, what were some of the authors that you were reading initially?
Yeah, well, my mother loved historical novels, and she started me off as a kid with kind of Dumas, you know, Raffaele Sabatini, Scaramouche, all that stuff. Baroness Orczy, Scarlet Pimpernel. Mm. And then I sort of graduated through to Mary Renault, whose books I love very, very much.
She wrote the Greek mythology.
Greek mythology, yes. The Last of the Wine and the Charity, all the Charity is Modern. And then I got on to the more modern people, like, of course, Georgette Hare, who used to come up to Scotland for her holidays, believe it or not. And I met her son, who's very romantic-looking, lawyer. And also, let me think, Dorothy Sayers, not historical at all, but, you know, people who are looking for derivations immediately pick up the first. I think the influence of everything you have ever read shows in your very first book. And for good or for evil, the first book I ever wrote was the first book, which is, you know, the seminal book of the entire 14. So it's remained in being ever since. And you can see, I'm sure, echoes of, certainly of Georgette Hare. The hero at the beginning, you start the first page or two, and he is cold, and he is arrogant, and he is brutal. And if you read him in 1961, you opened a book like that, you knew immediately this was the misunderstood hero. No question. Nowadays, people read, and if they read about an arrogant brute in page one, they think it's an analysis of the career of an arrogant brute, and they really don't want to go on. I keep saying, go on, go on. He's wonderful, really. Stick with it. Mm. They're the main influences, I'm sure.
Dorothy, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's been wonderful.
That was the late Dorothy Dunnett, recorded back in the year 2000. We call it the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. That was my only interview with Dorothy. She came out to see us here in Yellow Springs, and what an amazing woman. What a life of accomplishment she led, and I was absolutely charmed by her. She began writing novels late in life. Her first one came out in 1961, and then she had a 40-year career as a novelist and closed it out with that novel we were talking about back in 2000, Gemini. As she mentioned, she had been married to a journalist. In 1946, she married Sir Alastair Dunnett, editor of the Scotsman newspaper, and he wrote an autobiography in 1984 called Among Friends, talking about his life with her. Of course, he wasn't Sir Alastair when they married. He became a knight in 1995, and that made her Lady Dunnett. But I never called her Lady Dunnett, even though she'd been Lady Dunnett for 5 years, because I didn't know she was a lady, or I would have done it. And she was so sweet to me. She was so kind. After the interview, she said, you know, I stay up late at night. If you're ever in Edinburgh, she said, give me a call. Come by. We'll have a glass of sherry together. And she said, I'm in the phone book. She said, just give a call next time you're in Edinburgh. And I was so delighted to have been invited. And if I'd ever been in Edinburgh during the following year, I can assure you I would have looked her up. Dorothy Dunnett. Wow, what an amazing talent. You've been listening to the best of the Book Nook on WYSO. For the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks, as always, for tuning in.